I want to briefly talk about how atheists steal reason from God, because reason is essential to anything, including science. If you can't reason, obviously you can't do science. So let's start with reason. Now, you may have heard that a lot of atheists today call themselves free thinkers. You've probably heard that term. If you go to a college campus, sometimes they'll have the free thinker club. And these are pretty well-known atheists. David Silverman up in the left-hand corner, he used to be the president of the American Atheist. I've debated him. Richard Dawkins on the right. The guy in the middle is a professor from Tufts University, Daniel Dennett. Christopher Hitchens down on the bottom right. How many have heard the name Christopher Hitchens? Yeah, Christopher Hitchens, he passed away, but he was a brilliant British atheist who sounded more brilliant than he was because he had a British accent. And I had a couple of debates with him. They're on our YouTube channel, you can see. And the man on the bottom left is Steven Weinberg, who is a professor at UT Austin. He said that science certainly leads to atheism. That's his view anyway. Well, most atheists today are what we call materialists. They think everything's made of molecules. There is no immaterial realm. You don't have a soul. You're just a body. There is no immaterial realm. You're nothing but a moist robot because you are completely governed by the laws of physics. There's no self. You're just a molecular machine. And so they'll say things like this. All thoughts are determined by the laws of physics. Now, if someone were to say that to you, what question might you ask them back? Anybody? You'll have to speak loudly. Yeah, that's right, Mike. You could say what caused you to think that, or you could also say this. Is that one, too, caused by the laws of physics? Because if that thought is determined by the laws of physics, why should you believe anything you think? And the best tool you can use to point out that these atheistic claims are false is to turn the claim on itself. So if somebody says all thoughts are determined by the laws of physics, just ask them, is that thought determined by the laws of physics? If somebody says all truth is relative, if you turn the claim on itself, you're going to say, is that truth relative? If somebody says there is no truth, you're going to turn that claim on itself and say, is that true, right? See, because they actually are affirming what they are denying. This is known as a self-defeating statement. To say all thoughts are determined by the laws of physics, that would mean that thought's determined by the laws of physics, and we'd have no warrant to believe it then. Now, this idea of materialism was, I think, very succinctly refuted by none other than C.S. Lewis, who said everything well. And here is a quote from C.S. Lewis. You'll have to stay with me on this. It's a two-page quote, but let's see if we can follow Lewis on this. Are you ready? Here's what he said. Suppose there were no intelligence beyond the or behind the universe. In that case, nobody designed my brain for the purpose of thinking. Thought is merely the byproduct of some atoms within my skull. That's what materialism says. But if so, how can I trust my own thinking to be true? You with him so far? Okay. Then he said, but if I can't trust my own thinking, of course I can't trust the arguments leading to atheism, and therefore have no reason to be an atheist or anything else. Unless I believe in God, I can't believe in thought, so I can never use thought to disbelieve in God. Boom! I mean, what else can you say but boom? He nailed it, right? In fact, John Lennox, I don't know if you know who John Lennox is. He's a brilliant mathematician and philosopher from Oxford University. He's debated Richard Dawkins. And Lennox is the nicest, most jovial Irishman you'll ever meet. Dawkins, on the other hand, can be a bit of a sourpuss, which is why one of the reviewers of their debate said, watching John Lennox debate Richard Dawkins was like watching Santa Claus debate the devil. Anyway, at one point, Lennox asked his atheistic colleagues this question. He said, how do you do science? And the atheistic colleague would normally refer to some piece of machinery. And he goes, no, I don't mean how you do science in the lab. I mean, how do you do science right here? And they would say, you mean with my mind? They start to say mind and they catch themselves because they don't really believe in a mind. They just believe in a brain. And he said, they would say, you mean with my brain? And Lennox would say, yeah, tell me the origin of your brain. And the atheist would say, well, my brain was put together by processes without any thought in mind. It's a random creation. It just came really by chance. And then Lennox would say, and you trust it? I mean, why would you trust such a thing? If a computer could be put together by blind natural forces, would you trust anything it said? No. The only reason you should believe in thought is because you can trust your mind. The question is, what's the origin of your mind? If it's not a great mind, you have no reason to believe it. And certainly you have no reason to believe it if you're just a molecular machine, a moist robot, which led J.B.S. Haldane to say this: if my mental processes are determined wholly by the motions of atoms in my brain, I have no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true, and hence I have no reason for supposing my brain to be composed of atoms. Can everybody see the self-defeating nature of materialism? They have no way to affirm why they should be able to believe anything. In fact, Daniel Dennett thinks consciousness is an illusion. Well, one wonders if he was conscious when he wrote that, right? I mean, he doesn't think his own consciousness is an illusion, right? He needs consciousness to write books to say that consciousness is an illusion. In fact, here's the main problem I see with atheists in issues like this. Atheists exempt themselves from their own theories. You know, they'll say something like, everybody's a molecular machine, except me. I'm not a molecular machine. Everyone's thoughts are caused purely by the laws of physics, except my thoughts. My thoughts are not composed, or I don't arrive at them completely by the laws of physics. They exempt themselves from their own theories. Do you know what the real superstition is? It's not Christianity. The real superstition is atheism. Because the truth is, you are not just a physical body, a mere molecular machine. That's a superstition we call atheism. The truth is, you are a soul with a body, a soul with a body. And if there is no immaterial realm, you should have no warrant to believe anything you think. But you can believe things you think. So you ought to then ask the question, well, why is that the case? Because there must be an intelligence beyond mine that created my own mind. Does that make sense? Anybody still there? All right, good. All right, next question. What about science? Now, there's a lot more in the book on reason, but stand by. I'm getting too hot just speaking here. Must be going through menopause or something. So either that or I'm sick. So stick with me. All right, so now let's deal with this issue of science. And my main thesis here is that science needs God. And that sounds so counterintuitive because you always hear people say it's exactly the opposite. Science has gotten rid of the need for God. I'm going to say, no, it actually needs God. And we're going to do this in three steps. The first thing we ought to do is define what we mean by science. The second is, what does science say about God? You might be surprised to the answer. And then number three, why does science need God? So let's start right here at point one. What is science? Now, if someone were to put a microphone in your face one day and say, hey, what is science? What would you say? What would you say? Someone say something loud. A discovery of what God what? Oh, a discovery of what God made. Okay, I see. That could be part of the definition. You know, thinking God's thoughts after him. That's what Kepler, I believe, said. The only reason we can trust or the only reason we can do science is because we can trust there's an orderly natural world out there and we're thinking God's thoughts after him. Really, it may sound strange, but there's no agreed upon definition of science, because if you define it too narrowly, you leave some things out that are science. If you define it too broadly, you wind up including things that aren't science. But I'm going to use Francis Bacon's definition and alter it a little bit. Science is a method of inquiry used to discover cause and effect relationships. It's a method of inquiry that we human beings use to discover cause and effect relationships. At a minimum, whenever you're doing science, you're trying to figure out what particular cause caused the effect before you. It's all about cause and effect, right? And there's at least two types of causes. There are intelligent causes, like a person. You know, a person writes a book. Who created the book? Okay, a person did. And then there are non-intelligent causes, like a natural process. In fact, let me give you an example of the difference between the two of these. How many have ever been to the Grand Canyon, right? Grand Canyon's a beautiful geologic formation. But if you're a scientist, a geologist, and you're trying to discover how is this canyon made, you might say wind, rain, erosion, a great flood perhaps could have created a canyon like this. But can everybody see the difference between this geologic formation and this geologic formation? Mount Rushmore, right? Certainly wind, rain, and erosion did not create the faces on Mount Rushmore. Not natural erosion, maybe political erosion, but not natural erosion. Because you can throw wind, rain, water at a bunch of rock, you'll never get these four presidents. That takes intelligence to do that. So all we're saying here is here's an example of a natural process, the Grand Canyon, and here's an example of an intelligent process or intelligent person, the Mount Rushmore. Two types of causes. Now, in addition to two types of causes, a critical distinction we need to make is there are also two types of science. The one type of science we're probably all very familiar with is something called empirical science. That's how things operate. How does a Ford Model T operate? How does it work, right? But forensic science or historic science deals with how things originated. Like, where did the Model T come from to begin with? Those are two different questions. One deals with how things operate today, cause and effect relationships today, natural forces. Maybe the laws of internal combustion can tell you how a Ford Model T works. But the laws of internal combustion will never tell you where the Ford Model T came from to begin with, right? So an empirical science deals more with technology. And we're very familiar with technology, like iPhones, right? We go, wow, this is amazing. This little computer I can carry around and it can distract me 24/7. This technology is something that is a marvel of human intuition or a human creation, right? But how an iPhone works isn't a big mystery to the people that put it together, right? Christian scientists and atheistic scientists don't disagree how technology works. We don't disagree how an iPhone works. But we might disagree on creation events. You see, that's an historical question. And the big three issues that Christians and atheists disagree over when it comes to science is, where did the universe come from? Where did first life come from? And where did subsequent life forms come from? Those cannot be discovered by doing empirical science. You can't go in the laboratory and study the origin of the universe, right? It happened once. It doesn't happen over and over again. You know, if the Big Bang is true, the Big Bang happened only once. It's not the Big Bang, 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 bang theory, right? You can't go in the laboratory and repeat it. It happened once. So it's an historical question. It's an historical science. It's a creation question. Same thing is true with first life. Same thing is true with new life forms. Do you know that creation and evolution are both historic sciences? You can't go in the laboratory and repeat them. They're historical events. So you have to use the principles that, say, a detective would use who's, like, say, investigating a murder. He can't go back in time and bring everybody back to life and witness the murder happening over and over again. All he can do is look at clues left over and try and discover what's the inference to the best explanation. What makes the most sense as to how this murder occurred or how this body was killed. So the key point I want to make here is make sure when people are talking about science that you differentiate between these two types of science. We don't have a lot of disagreement on empirical science. We do have a lot of disagreement on historic or forensic science, or some call it origin science, all right? So keep that in mind as we move forward. In fact, John Lennox, as I mentioned earlier, has a question. He asks his students, who created the Model T, or what's the cause of the Model T? And he says, Henry Ford or the laws of internal combustion? You can only pick one. And Lennox's students will say, well, Dr. Lennox, you actually need both. You need Henry Ford to create the Model T, and then you need the laws of internal combustion to be what they are to allow the Model T to continue working, because if the laws of internal combustion changed every 10 minutes, there'd be no way for the Model T to work or stay together. And Lennox would say, exactly. Why can't people like Richard Dawkins understand this? Right? The cause, the origin cause, is different than the empirical cause. The creation cause is different from the empirical cause. In fact, you could say it this way. To say that a scientist can disprove the existence of God is like saying a mechanic can disprove the existence of Henry Ford. That doesn't make any sense. You remember, some of you who are old enough, even if you weren't alive, the Russians beat us to space back in the late 50s. They sent Yuri Gagarin up into space. And when he came back, Gagarin said, I didn't see God up there. And so Leonid Brezhnev, no, it wasn't Brezhnev, it was Khrushchev, who said, look, Yuri didn't see God up there. There is no God. Now, what the Russians were confusing is the difference between empirical science and origin science or historical science. It would be like opening the hood of a Model T and saying, I don't see Henry Ford in there. I guess he doesn't exist. Right? Henry Ford is not part of the Model T. He created the Model T. His thoughts maybe can be detectable in the Model T, but he's not part of the Model T. Same thing is true with God. God created the universe, and he created you, but he's not the universe, and he's not you. When we say God is inside us, we don't mean literally, we mean relationally. The Holy Spirit. He's not, you know, if you cut a Christian open, you're not going to find God in there. You're not going to find a little Jesus in there. Okay? And so God is to the universe what Henry Ford is to the Model T. There's a little bit of difference here, but generally you can see God in his creation. You can see that there must be a creator. Same thing is true. There's got to be a designer of the Model T. Henry Ford isn't in the Model T, but his thoughts are expressed in the Model T. Does that make sense for anybody? Okay, good. So there's a difference between empirical science and historical science. Okay, good. We got that out of the way. Now we can move on to the second question. Science is an inquiry to discover cause and effect relationships. There are two types of causes, intelligent, non-intelligent, we might say natural. Two types of science, empirical and historic or forensic. All right, now, what does science say about God? Now, how many people... Well, actually, in order to do this, we've got to go back to O.J. All right, how many people out there have never heard of O.J. Simpson? Put your hand up. Anyone out there never heard of O.J. Simpson? Maybe a couple in the audience. O.J. Simpson was a great NFL running back. He won the Heisman Trophy with USC, actually, University of Southern California, because... The real USC was a college before California was a state. I don't know if you know that. The real USC is there in Columbia. All my three sons went there. But he went. This guy went to the University of Southern California. And in 1994, he was accused of a brutal slash-and-dash murder. His ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her boyfriend, Ron Goldman, were found slain on the sidewalk of a Brentwood home, Brentwood, California. And there literally was a trail of blood from O.J. Simpson, or from the crime scene to O.J. Simpson. I'm going to present some of the evidence that was presented at the trial and then ask you guys a question. First, O.J. Simpson's blood was at the scene of the crime. There's only a 1 in 170 million chance it's not his blood. Secondly, Goldman, Brown, and Simpson's blood were in Simpson's white Bronco. For those of you who are old enough, you remember he tried to evade police by driving through the L.A. freeways in his white Bronco, and blood was found in the Bronco from all three of them. Thirdly, the glove found at the scene had blood from all three and matched the glove at Simpson's house. So in the murder, he apparently dropped one of the gloves, and it was drenched in blood. It was found at the scene, and the other matching glove was found at his house. Now, this led to a dramatic situation in the courtroom when O.J. was going to try one of the gloves on, and he had a surgical glove on, and he tried to put the glove on, and his attorney said, if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. That's a great turn of a phrase Johnny Cochran had. Anyway, so O.J. tried to put the glove on. He couldn't quite put it on. Now, why couldn't he put it on? Number one, he had that surgical glove on. Number two, it had shrunk from the blood. Number three, he didn't want to put it on. Did you? Would you? Number four, the bloody footprints at the scene of the crime were from a rare brand of size 12 shoes that Simpson owned. There were only 199 pairs of these shoes sold in the United States, and Simpson owned one of them. Finally, number five, Brown's blood was on Simpson's socks. There is only a 1 in 21 billion chance it was not her blood. All this was presented at trial. Now, here's my question. Does science show that O.J. was guilty? How many say yes? Put your hands up. How many say no? How many say I'm not voting, it's a trick? The answer is no. Why? Because science doesn't say anything. Scientists do. Science doesn't say a word. If there were no human beings, would there be anything such as science? No. All data needs to be gathered. All data needs to be interpreted. And who does that? Scientists do that. And in the case of a court case like this, the jurors have to decide whether the evidence points more toward guilt or more towards innocence. Now, do I think O.J. was guilty? Of course he's guilty. But that's an assessment I need to make based on the evidence. Science doesn't make that assessment. Human beings make that assessment. In fact, to show you how the same evidence can be interpreted in different ways, there was a survey done 10 years after the murder. And here's what they discovered. 77% of people surveyed believed O.J. was guilty. However, there was an ethnic divide. While 87% of whites thought he was guilty, only 29% of blacks thought he was guilty. How do you come to the same conclusion, or I should say different conclusions, when you're looking at the same evidence? The only way that can happen is because your worldview may determine how you interpret the evidence. You see, blacks were understandably more open to the idea that this was a frame job because they've seen incidents like this happen before. They've been treated wrongly, racially, And so they're more open to the idea that maybe OJ was innocent, whereas White said, nah, we don't see that. We're going to look at the evidence and just take it at face value. Notice, same evidence, two different conclusions. Your worldview may determine how you interpret the evidence. Now, personally, I don't think there's any way he could have been framed. First of all, there was no motive to frame him. Everybody loved OJ. I loved OJ. Number three, it's too difficult to do. There was blood everywhere. Why would they do this? The fourth reason, by the way, for those of you who don't know, he was found not guilty. And there's been documentaries done on this. It wouldn't matter if they had videotape of OJ killing these people. That jury was never going to convict him. They said that after the trial. So he was found not guilty. Now, he was found guilty later on in a civil case. And he also went to prison for armed robbery. And he's since gotten out of prison. And apparently now he can devote his full time and attention to discovering who the true killer is, right? But he's out there right now. Now, this same worldview issue also applies to, say, evolution. You guys ever heard of Piltdown Man? Piltdown Man was a discovery made in 1912 in Piltdown, England, where the British Museum reconstructed fragments of a skull and jawbone, and they held it as a link between ape and man. They thought they had found the so-called missing link. The problem was, in 1923, it was revealed as a hoax. It was a combination of a human skull, orangutan jaw, chimpanzee teeth, but the scientific community did not concede it until 1953. For 30 years, they continued to believe this was really a missing link, even when it had been revealed to be a hoax. Why? Because their worldview determined how they interpreted the evidence. They already knew in their hearts, they thought in their hearts evolution was true. So there's no way this could be a fake, but it was a fake. So you always have to keep that in mind, that your worldview can determine how you interpret the evidence. In fact, let's fast forward to a more modern day. Again, this is Richard Dawkins. And Richard Dawkins was once asked a question by the Berkeley attorney Philip Johnson, who wrote a seminal book back in 1991 called Darwin on Trial, great book. And he emailed Dawkins once and he asked him, what's the best evidence you have for macroevolution? You know, from the goo to you via the zoo. No intelligence at all. And here's what Dawkins wrote back. The reason we know for certain that we are all related, including bacteria, is the universality of the genetic code and other biochemical fundamentals. In other words, we all share a common genetic code, and that shows we must have a common ancestor. That obviously could be interpreted. That data could be interpreted that way. How else could it be interpreted? Anyone? Instead of a common ancestor, it could be a common creator, couldn't it? Or a common designer. Yeah, we all have, actually, there's more than one genetic code, but there's one that's dominant, so we'll give Dawkins grace there. But he's saying we have this same genetic code, so we must have a common ancestor. Could be a common ancestor, could also be a common creator, but his worldview won't allow him to even consider that possibility. You remember those two types of causes, intelligent and natural? He's already ruled intelligent causes out. So the only cause available to him is a natural cause. And that's why he's coming to this conclusion. He's not even open to the evidence, just like that O.J. Simpson jury. They're not open to the fact that O.J. did it. They've already decided it can't be O.J. So it doesn't matter how much the evidence points towards intelligence here. He's never going to say that it was an intelligent being that created subsequent life forms. And this has actually led to some comical errors that some evolutionists have made. Here's one. A Darwinist by the name of Tim Barra introduced the progression of the Corvette as evidence of descent with modification. I mean, look, it looks like the 63 came from the 53 and the 68 from the 63 and the 78 from the 68. It looks like there's some sort of descent with modification, some sort of evolutionary process going on here. What's the problem with this kind of thinking, however? Anyone? Yes, Corvettes are designed This is now known as Barra's blunder because this is an illustration of intelligent design. This isn't evidence of anything. It's just an illustration of what happens when human beings decide to create an automobile. They use the same engineering principles and many of the same design principles, but that doesn't prove there's no, or there's some sort of evolutionary, non-intelligent process that's causing this. This is caused by intelligence. This is intelligent design. Now, we could ask ourselves the question, just how did we get here? Right? Now, if you look at the evidence for macroevolution, there's two basic categories of evidence that they say point toward a non-intelligent process causing all subsequent life forms. DNA and homology. DNA meaning the genetic code, the genome. In every one of your cells, there's a computer program, a software program that's 3.2 billion letters long. All the letters are in the right order, save an error here or two. That appears to be the product of intelligence. And also homology, that deals with the fact that your structure is similar. And look, our structure is similar to the apes, right? We stand upright, we have two arms, two legs. We kind of do look like apes. So they're saying that DNA and homology shows that we have a common ancestor. Now, if you ask them the question, well, why could that not be evidence of a common designer? They will say, because evolution's true. And then you ask them, well, how do you know evolution's true? And they say DNA and homology. Can anybody see that this is called circular reasoning? You would need evidence outside of DNA and homology to see which way the evidence points. I don't have time to get into it here, but in the book, Stealing from God, this book right here, I go into some detail on this. I think that not only is there not good evidence for macroevolution, I think there's evidence against it. And I'll just list a few things here that I don't have time to explain. The fossil record does not agree with macroevolution. Irreducible complexity is a barrier they can't get past. Also, epigenetic information, which is the structure of a cell, that is necessary to have living things. You also have no ancestral relationship at the molecular level between these large life forms. There's many other reasons to say it's just not plausible, all right? So whenever you ask this question, you have to take into account all the evidence, and I think the evidence points much more strongly to an intelligent designer than a natural process. And even if you were to say a natural process were responsible for this, as we're about to see here in a minute, you would still need someone like God to create the universe, create these natural processes that drive the process itself. But I'll get to that later, all right? So, answer the question then, what does science say about God? What is the real answer? If someone were to say, what does science say about God, what would you say? Yeah, science doesn't say anything about God because science doesn't say anything about anything. It's human beings that use science that interpret the data in such a way as to say it either points toward God or a point away from God. By the way, this is why you get all sorts of conflicting information on things like climate change and the coronavirus. Why? Because human beings gather data and interpret data differently. And sometimes they don't have enough data. So they're making educated guesses. And sometimes the process is just too complicated. They can't trace every cause and effect, right? It's really hard to do. So that's why you get all sorts of different advice on so many different issues. And by the way, you're going to see, you know, like the president, Biden will say, well, we're following science. What does that mean? Who's science, right? Which scientist said that? You got another scientist saying the opposite over here. So which science are you going to follow? It's not always clear. Sometimes it is, but many times it isn't. So science doesn't say a thing. I will say this, though. You can use science to discover truths about the universe that when you interpret those truths, you say, this must be a piece of evidence for an intelligent being. What do I mean by that? When we go through, I don't have enough faith to be an atheist, we give evidence that the universe had a beginning. You can get evidence that the universe had a beginning. Now, if it had a beginning, you're probably thinking, okay, it must have had a beginner. Yeah, it had a beginner. Okay, so you're taking what you discover in science and then drawing an inference to a cause. Science doesn't tell you it's God, but you're drawing an inference. If space, time, and matter had a beginning, which is what just about everybody agrees with now, then whatever created space, time, and matter can't be made of space, time, and matter. In other words, the cause must be spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful to create the universe out of nothing, personal in order to choose to create. Because to go from a state of nothingness to a state of creation, someone had to make a choice, and only persons make choices. The being would also have to be intelligent to be able to make a choice. So, ladies and gentlemen, when you think about a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, personal, intelligent being, who do you think of? God. You say, well, how do you know it's the Christian God? And the answer is we don't. Yet, we haven't done enough research yet. We have to see if Jesus rose from the dead, and we got to do historical research for that. If Jesus rose from the dead, then it seems that the same being that created the universe out of nothing is the same being that walked out of the tomb 1,988 years ago in his human nature, Jesus. Okay, but you don't get all the way to God in any one argument other than the resurrection. You don't get to the God of the Bible just from, say, the beginning of the universe or the design of the universe or the design of life. You get elements that point maybe to God. It could be Allah, right? It could be some other God. But when you put all the arguments together, you get the attributes of the God of the Bible. But no one argument gets you all the way there, all right? Now let's deal with this question. Why does science need God? We know what science is. We know that science doesn't say anything about God one way or the other, but you can use science to get evidence for God interpreted properly. So the question is, why does science need God? And you may have heard people say this: all truth comes from science. Have you heard this? This is called scientism. If someone were to say this to you, what question would you ask them? Say it louder. You know, you guys sound like Charlie Brown's teacher. Wah, 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 wah. Okay. Actually, the question you're going to ask them, go back to what we did earlier. You're going to turn the claim on itself and say, does that truth come from science? Is that a scientific truth? No, that's a philosophical claim. You can't go in the laboratory and prove that. That's a philosophical claim. So what you're doing again here is you're turning the claim on itself. In fact, most of what you don't know from science. You know, in fact, most of the most important things in life have nothing to do with science. Honey, do you love me? I don't know. Let's run an experiment. No! Right? You wouldn't say run an experiment. You either do or you don't. In fact, life is delicious because it has nothing to do with science in most cases. So you might ask yourself the question, what can't science explain? Now, in order for me to explain this to you, I'm going to use a clip from a debate that I happened to be at a number of years ago. It was in Atlanta, Georgia. It was between William Lane Craig. How many have heard of William Lane Craig? Raise your hands if you would. Okay, for those of you that don't, haven't heard of him, he's probably the best debater for Christianity in the past 35 years. He has a website called reasonablefaith.org. You ought to avail yourself of that. And Craig was debating a guy by the name of Peter Atkins, who is a chemist from Oxford University, an atheist. And the moderator of this debate was William Buckley. You guys remember William Buckley? He used to have a show on PBS. He was a very eccentric conservative. He wrote the book Men and God at Yale, and Buckley could get away with things that nobody else could get away with. As the moderator, he made it known that he wasn't going to be neutral. He was a Catholic himself, and he was on Craig's side, right? So as he introduced the two debaters, he said this. He said, representing the Christian position is Dr. William Lane Craig. Representing the devil is Dr. Peter Atkins. That's how he started the debate. Anyway, the two men had their debate, and after their opening statements, they were sitting on these chairs. And at one point, Atkins said to Craig, "Do you deny that science can explain everything?" And Craig said, "Yes, I do deny science can explain everything." He went in a 5-point refutation as to why science can't explain everything. Now, the reason this came up is because Buckley was trying to debate Atkins himself, and he wasn't really getting anywhere. So he turned it over to Craig, and he said, "Dr. Craig, you want to jump in here?" And that's when this whole exchange took place. Now, two things I want you to pay attention to in addition to what Craig says. I want you to pay attention to Atkins, because when Craig is talking, he looks lost. He looks completely like a deer in the headlights. And then secondly, listen to what Buckley says at the very end. Craig is the one with the beard. Buckley's the moderator, and Atkins has this tan jacket on. Okay, it's about 2 minutes long. Are you ready? All right, here we go.
"There is no need for the God. And everything in the world can be understood without needing to invoke a God. You have to accept that that is one possible view to take about the world."
"Sure, that's possible.
Okay. Do you deny that science cannot account for everything?"
"Yes, I do deny that science..."
"So what can't it account for?"
"Well, had you brought that up in the debate, I had a number of examples that I was going to give. I think there are a good number of things that cannot be scientifically proven, but that we're all rational to accept. Let me list five. Logical and mathematical truths cannot be proven by science. Science presupposes logic and math, so that to try to prove them by science would be arguing in a circle. Metaphysical truths, like there are other minds other than my own, or that the external world is real, or that the past was not created 5 minutes ago with an appearance of age, are rational beliefs that cannot be scientifically proven. Ethical beliefs about statements of value are not accessible by the scientific method. You can't show by science whether the Nazi scientists in the camps did anything evil as opposed to the scientists in Western democracies. Aesthetic judgments, number four, cannot be accessed by the scientific method because the beautiful, like the good, cannot be scientifically proven. And finally, most remarkably, would be science itself. Science cannot be justified by the scientific method. Science is permeated with unprovable assumptions. For example, in the special theory of relativity, the whole theory hinges on the assumption that the speed of light is constant in a one-way direction between any two points, A and B. But that strictly cannot be proven. We simply have to assume that in order to hold to the theory. None of these beliefs can be scientifically proven, and yet they are accepted by all of us, and we're rational in doing so."
Did you hear what Buckley said at the end? He said, "So put that in your pipe and smoke it." He said, because, you know, he was debating Atkins and he wasn't getting anywhere. And then Craig gave that eloquent 5-point refutation. In case you're keeping score at home, this is what Craig said. "Science can't explain logical and mathematical truths." Why? Well, you can't go in the laboratory and prove the laws of logic or the laws of math. You need the laws of logic and the laws of math in order to do science. In other words, they're the foundation of science. You can't prove metaphysical truths, like there's a real world out there. This is called realism, that you believe there's a real world out there. And your mind can ascertain truths about the real world so you can draw true conclusions about cause and effect relationships, which is what scientists do, right? They try to discover cause and effect relationships. Why should you trust that your mind can get these truths and draw conclusions about the real world? You're assuming that. You can't prove it by science. How about moral and ethical truths, that murder's wrong? University of Michigan a number of years ago did a survey of scientists, and they tried to ask the question, have you ever fudged your results to get the or fudged your data to get the results you wanted. A full third of scientists admitted to doing so. Why? Well, because maybe they're being funded by a particular company or a particular university or a particular entity that wants a certain result. They will fudge their data to get it. This is why almost a good portion of experiments and findings can never be replicated. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that all scientists are dishonest, but there's a lot more going on here than what meets the eye. Scientists are just like the rest of us. We're tempted by sex, money, and power. And they, you know, we can sometimes lie to get the results we want. And you can't put morality in a test tube. You have to bring morality to the scientific endeavor to say you ought not fudge your data. You ought to report your findings truthfully. You can't prove that by science. You need that in order to do science. Aesthetic truths like beauty can't be discovered by science. And science itself is built on a number of metaphysical, meaning beyond the physical truths that can't be proven by science itself. Here's a drawing that my friend Jay Warner Wallace did for me. It's in the book, Stealing from God. And what it's showing is that before you're conducting an experiment or historical investigation, when you're conducting it or how you interpret it, you're relying on philosophical presuppositions through the entire process that you can't prove by science. Morality, free will, logic, realism, uniformity, reason, orderly natural laws, and causality itself. I don't have time to go through all these. They're all in the book, Stealing from God. But I just want to drill down on one of them. That's orderly natural laws. Why are the laws so orderly? It's required to do science, right? If the natural laws changed every 10 minutes, first of all, we wouldn't exist, and we therefore couldn't do science, even if we did exist. So the question I want to ask is, why is nature so orderly? For example, why do the planets revolve around the sun? And you might say, well, Frank, that's easy, gravity. Yeah, but why does gravity do what it does? You ever ask yourself that question? Do you know there's really only four natural forces out there? Gravity, strong and weak nuclear forces, and electromagnetism, light. Those are the four known forces that we know about. Where did they come from? And by the way, the combination of those give us what we call natural law. Why are they the way they are? Why are they so precise? Why are they so orderly? Why don't they change? Do you know that all physical things change? I change, you change, all physical things change. Why don't the laws that govern physical things change? Where do they come from? Aristotle noticed something about 2,400 years ago. And he noticed that everything in nature is going in a direction. For example, where do oak trees come from? Well, oak trees come from acorns, right? Now, if you properly nourish an acorn, it's eventually going to give you an oak tree. The question is, why do acorns always give oak trees? Why don't they result in elm trees or birch trees or seahorses? Well, because you say an acorn is programmed to become an oak tree. Yeah, well, who programmed it? And is an acorn conscious? Is an acorn in the ground going, all right, what do I have to do to become an oak tree? No. But if it's properly nourished, it reliably goes in a direction of becoming an oak tree. If it doesn't have a mind of its own, and yet it goes in a direction, there must be an external mind directing that acorn toward an oak tree. That is what Aristotle called the unmoved mover. Thomas Aquinas came along in the 1200s AD, and he said, this is my fifth way to argue for God. In other words, he's noticed that everything's going in a direction. If it's going in a direction, there must be a director, a being beyond the universe who created the universe and sustains the universe every single second. In fact, Aristotle's unmoved mover argument, which is Aquinas' fifth way to argue for God, is not a cause way back in history, like a Big Bang cause or a cause at the beginning of the universe. This is a cause every single second, a sustaining cause. And it's, I think, one of the best arguments for the existence of God. And the same is true, by the way, when it comes to oak trees. The same thing is true with you. I mean, this is you in the womb at 11 weeks, right? Hey, question, is this animal, mineral, vegetable, or human? Yeah, it's a human being in there. And if we were to go back in time to when your mother and your father got together to conceive you. By the way, have you guys had this talk before? Okay, when your mother and your father got together to conceive you, there was so much goal-directed activity that it had to be the process of intelligence. For example, your mother unconsciously perfumed her egg to attract your father. And then your father sent the entire population of the United States, 300 million soldiers, toward your mother's egg. And then there was a race. And you won! Don't let anyone ever tell you you're not special. You beat out 300 million others. You have blown away anything Michael Phelps has done. Now, seeing some of you limp into the room earlier makes it hard for me to believe you were the fastest soldier in the gene pool, but you were. Now, your soldier was 20 to 30 times smaller than a grain of salt, yet it contained half of the genetic information that makes you you. And your mother's egg was about the size of a period at the end of a sentence in an average book, and it contained the other half of the genetic information that makes you you. You know, the other half of the 3.2 billion letter software program. And when your soldier and your egg came together, a new 100% genetic human being was created. You have not made any more genetic information from that point till right now. In fact, there are only four things separating you from adulthood: time, air, water, and food. Those are the same four things that separate a two-year-old from adulthood. Does this have implications on the abortion issue? Yeah, I think it does. We don't kill the two-year-old. Why do we kill the unborn child in the womb? Genetically, it's the same. Now, some will say, well, Frank, you know, you can't legislate morality. Okay, no extra charge for this. We covered this in the Q&A before, but let me re-emphasize it. All laws legislate morality. Every law declares one behavior right and the opposite behavior wrong, right? What the pro-abortion people want to do is they want to impose death on the baby. Pro-lifers want to impose continued pregnancy on the mother. Both are trying to impose something. The only question is, what's right to impose? And as I mentioned earlier, when people say, don't impose your morality on me, I say, this is not my morality. This is the morality. I didn't make any of this stuff up. If you don't like it, you don't have a problem with me. You have a problem with the creator upon whose nature this morality is derived. All right, no extra charge for that. Let's go back to this. From this point till right now, a construction project of astonishing complexity began taking place. Cells began multiplying at a rate of 4,000 cells per second. Brain cells began multiplying at a rate of 100,000 cells per second. For most of you, anyway. Some cells became heart cells, others lung cells. Others, brain cells. How did they know how to do this? Nobody knows. Some cells went so far across you to become what they needed to become that it would be equivalent to you today walking across the United States alone. And that construction project continues to this day. You just made 4 million new red blood cells. You just made another 4 million new red blood cells. You just made another 4 million new red bloods. Knock it off. How do you know how to do this? Are you thinking about this? Are you going, hold on, Frank, I got to concentrate. New red blood cells coming up. No, this is just happening. Why? David knew. He didn't know about blood cells, but he knew that for you created my inmost being, you knit me together in my mother's womb. He knew that there had to be a force out there that did all this. In fact, there's got to be a mind out there that created these processes, directs these processes, and sustains these processes. This is why Paul said this: Christ is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he said, in him we live and move and have our being. You see, God just doesn't create the universe and then he leaves it. God creates the universe and he sustains the natural laws and the universe and you every single second of existence. The writer of Hebrews says this: the sun is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. We forget that sustaining. God, it just isn't a historical cause. He's a present cause. Every single second you draw breath, God is sustaining creation and the natural laws that allow you to do that. In fact, God is to the universe what a band is to music. If a band were playing music right now, the band would be creating and sustaining the music. What would happen to the music the second the band stops playing? Music's over, right? Same thing is true with God. God creates the universe, and he creates you and all the natural forces, and then he sustains the universe, and he sustains you and all the natural forces every single second of the day. Just like a band sustains the music, creates and sustains the music. Sir Fred Hoyle, who is an atheist astronomer, after looking at arguments like this, including the fine-tuning of the universe, which I didn't have time to get into, he was an atheist, but he admitted this. He said, a common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. Yeah, there's no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. There's a mind behind all this, the mind that created and sustains everything. In fact, here's what God does. We forget. We know that God creates, and we know that God intervenes through miracles when he needs to affirm a prophet of God or something like that. But what we forget is that God sustains. That's the middle one. He's sustaining the universe every single second. And even if there were no miracles, you'd still have evidence for God, because you would need God to create the universe and sustain it. Even if he doesn't intervene in, you know, with miracles in the space-time continuum, he's the one that created and sustains the space-time continuum. So without him, we wouldn't exist. And without him, to answer the question, why does science need God? Because we need God to create a universe and sustain the natural laws, including the cause and effect laws, which allow us to discover how cause and effect relationships exist. And that's what science is. If you didn't have a stable universe, if you didn't have consistent, precise natural laws, science would be impossible. And what best explains those laws? What best explains the universe? A being like God.